everyone. Welcome back to Why Am I So Happy? Paula V here, your host. I am just so happy to have everyone with us today. I appreciate all of my listeners. I have a really great guy with us today to share with you. I am very excited to chat with him. Today we have Alan McNair. He is a published writer of short and epic poetry. He has illustrated his work in marker art and acrylics. He's written and published a major work, I Dream of Amaresh, through CreateSpace and Author House. We're going to be able to hear about that today. I'm so excited. He contributed his earliest work to Threshold Literary Magazine, The Musing Place, and the Chicago Writing Alliance publication, Journal of Ordinary Thought. In 1990, straight out of Columbia College in Chicago with a bachelor's degree, he lost his job, became homeless, and much of his early writing of poetry was inspired by this shocking experience of losing his housing. I am so thrilled to have you on the show and honored and have you share your beautiful story with us. So, Alan, first off, I want to say welcome. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Please tell the listeners about your personal story. How did your father's depression, which he self-medicated with alcohol, and subsequent threats of leaving the family impact your young life as a boy?
Well, my future seemed to be very uncertain with the threat of my father leaving the family. And so when I was in high school, I got a little bit nervous about going away to college to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, at Cole College, away from home. And so when I was in high school, unfortunately, somebody in front of my pronunciation of a Spanish word, and instead of taking it out on him, I took it out on myself and tried to go out the third floor window of my high school Spanish class. Fortunately, the teacher brought me back in, took me to the counselor's office, and I went to the Lutheran General Hospital diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. And what happened after that? Tell us about it.
Okay, well, in 1969, when I was still in high school, I found this book that had a psychedelic cover, and this Indian mystic and monk, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and he introduced a technique that he said was too delicate to be taught in books but should be taught by a certified teacher, a DM. And the more I learned about transcendental meditation, the more I realized that it was a beautiful way to relax and stir up my creativity. So I decided when I was in college to learn the technique. And I found it very soothing and very helpful and very strengthening of my ego.
Gotcha. How long were you homeless, Alan?
I was homeless from 1990 through the year of 1990, but eventually in 1991 I was able to get into assisted living because I was in a shelter where they said, if you really want to continue to be in the shelter, you should show that you want to eventually get out of it and improve your life. And so they introduced me to Thresholds, which helped me with counseling and housing and jobs. And so I was able to, as they say, pull myself up from my bootstraps.
Yes.
And eventually get work and live on my own.
Yes. I can only imagine what that's like. Here, I'm in Washington State, and we have a lot of homeless, and it just tears me up. You know, we have to fight to do more for them. And I, being a Reiki practitioner, I've actually offered Reiki to the homeless before at one of the nearby shelters. And oh my gosh, I can just imagine, you know, what that must put someone through.
Yes, but it was a very stirring experience as well as a shocking one. It stirred my creativity, and I decided to write for the Musing Place magazine and Thresholds and actually edit the magazine. So I was able to teach myself to draw and illustrate my poetry and be very creative and very self-productive.
Oh, that's awesome that, you know, you created something so positive during that time. That is very inspiring. And I understand, Alan, that you have traveled around the world. And in January of 1971, you visited England for a month, where you met a beautiful female college student who was studying witchcraft. Tell us, what is it doppelganger experience? And what was your experience like for that? That's something I have never heard of.
Okay, doppelganger is a body double, but it's a spiritual being rather than a physical being. So, but she looks exactly like the person that you're familiar with and looks quite human. So what happened was my friend who studied witchcraft decided to visit Dublin, Ireland for the weekend. So that evening I went to a dance hall and I met this woman, asked her to dance. We danced for several numbers, and all the while she was very quiet. She didn't even speak a word, but she was very affirmative and very encouraging of my dancing and paying attention to her. So I felt that she was actually my friend being represented by a doppelganger.
Yes, yes. And in November 9th... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Alan.
I'm sorry. But I think that she was more of a spiritual guide that prevented me from getting into any further mischief while my friend was gone.
Yes, yes. And I understand in November 1970, you learned a spiritual and scientific practice, transcendental meditation. How has that changed your life? What is that, and what did that do for you, Alan?
Okay, transcendental meditation is a scientifically proven technique of relaxation where you're given the sound and you're introduced on how to pay attention to that sound when you have your eyes closed. So you have your eyes closed for about 15 minutes, and you actually experience subtler and subtler, more expansive areas of thought, so that your subconscious becomes more conscious and you're able to utilize the potential of your full range of abilities through coming out of the practice and engaging in life.
Wow. Oh, how cool. I love that. I love that. So is that something you do a lot of?
I do it twice a day for now 30 minutes a day. And I do it every day of my life. I've done it for more than 40 years.
Wow. Oh, that is awesome, Alan. Is it pretty easy to learn the practice?
Yes, it is. It's very easy to learn. People have found that when they've tried other meditation techniques, there's a bit of concentration or focus involved, and there's no focus at all in this innocent, easy, effortless procedure. So people find that they gain results very quickly, and they're very surprised at how easy it is to relax.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And really, isn't it so important for us to have those moments of relaxation in our life to bring ourselves to that?
Yes, it is. And it's also it stirs the creativity and productivity of people. They found that executives become much more able to problem solve when they do the practice.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Isn't that wonderful? that when they relax and they do that kind of practice, they become more creative. So they probably, it helps them balance what they're doing, come up with ideas, execute. I love it. I love it. How did you learn about it, Alan?
How did I learn about it?
Yes.
I read a book, and the more that Maharishi talked about being and the art of living and the way to dynamically use your full potential, I found it was just the thing for me, and I decided to do it, and I've been doing it ever since and have never looked back.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, well, we are going to pop out for a quick break. So, Alan, we will be right back. Everyone, I will be right back with Alan McNair. Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I am here with Alan McNair. We are going to jump in now and discuss Alan's amazing graphic novel, Amoresh. Alan, please tell us a bit about that. Let's start with what inspired you to write it?
Okay, what inspired me to write the book I Dreamed of Amoresh was a dream that I had in 1965 when I was still in high school about a nuclear holocaust. And then 200 years after the holocaust, the world was healed to be a very forest-like planet. And so this woman, through an accident in space, Amoresh, came to our world, and she fell in love with this woodsman from our planet. They married and had a child, and unfortunately, the child contracted a disease, which originally in the dream was contracted by the parent. But I decided that she was too intelligent a person to actually succumb to a disease easily. So it had to be through subterfuge that another evil woman, Pandaray, got her daughter sick, so she had to cure her daughter, and the rest is up to the reader to find out what happens after she cures her daughter.
Wow, fascinating. When did you actually first sit down to write out this tale?
In 1992.
Wow. What lessons? Go ahead.
No, what are you saying?
What lessons for the challenges of life were you hoping for the readers to gain when you sat down to write this?
I was hoping that people would learn to be of service to one another with respect and love and compassion. I had hoped that they could combat evil when they saw it through doing good. And I hope that people reading this book would be inspired to do some creative things themselves and possibly write another tale of amazing adventure and curiosity, just as this one was composed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how fun, Alan. Could you share something from the novel for us?
Yes, I'm going to read the first poem called Festival of Welcome, the first part. Each chapter has two poems, two parts to each chapter. And I'm just going to read the first half of the first poem in Festival of Welcome. Love's sweet flower blooms in Mandolin's cottage. Village seer and woodsman, he shares his home and all his worldly wisdom gladly with the celestial beauty, Amoresh. He introduces her to the wonders of his lonely world. Forest creatures on the ground and those of air feel kindly mental touch of these tourist explorers too. His eyes open in an owl's steady stare as she walks the tall grass in a snake's sensuous slither. Each laugh with sight of others tempts to be an animal. Thus engaged, they spend many hours of joyous playing. They both ride the mental zephyrs of this brand new world in friendly competition, comparing new amazing sights. They share their far-vision glimpses and scenes from the various villages which the white seers serve in selfless sacrifice. Learning from each other, they draw closer in their emotions, heart to heart, mind to mind, beyond in beautiful felicity.
Oh, I love it. I love it, Alan. And so you know, this, it sounds like this is really going to be very inspiring for people and very supportive.
Thank you. I hope so.
Yes. Yes. Would you say that's one of your biggest goals with this novel?
Yeah, my biggest goal is to inspire hope in the world as we see it.
Yes. Yes. And that is a really good thing. That is what we need, and I love that you put that out there. Tell the listeners how they could get a copy of this novel, Alan.
Okay, it's in paperback and also in electronic book through Amazon.com. And you just Google Amazon.com, you go on their site, and you then enter in the words, "I Dream of Amoresh." And if you spell it correctly, Amaresh, you should be able to get the book, and you look for a blue cover.
The fact
right
that,
now,
go ahead, yes.
Sorry, and right now, as of last looking at it, for the holidays, it's at a special price of $5. It might be less or a little bit more, but it's very inexpensive to acquire a book during the holiday season.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, thank you. Would you say the fact that you have traveled the world, did that experience, those experiences, that the perspectives they gave you, would you say they had anything to do with what you put into your novel?
Well, I tried to create a world, not just characters in a world. And so I put many layers of thought into this and illustrated it. So I feel that it's a very edifying and very encouraging work, and I'm very proud of having accomplished this.
Yes, that's a great accomplishment. It is. Do you see yourself writing any other novels?
At the present time, I have two novels in the works.
Awesome.
Sequels to this book. One is called The Secret Book of Pandaray, about the villainess that perpetrated the illness on Amersh's daughter, and then The Lost Book of Herbert.
I love it. I love it. And so these are going to be sequels from this first book.
Yes.
Yes. When do you expect to have those available?
Well, The Secret Book of Pandaray is available on CreateSpace right now. The Lost Book of Herbert, I have a couple of illustrations that I want to include in the book, and I need to find a good photographer that would be willing to take a good digital copy of the illustrations.
Yes, yes. It sounds like writing these novels is really a great creative, you know, passion for you. Would you say that's true? Have you found your passion in this type of work and this sharing with others?
Yes.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Had you thought about this most of your life? I mean, I know you started making notes, working on things when you were young. So I'm guessing you have really been passionate about writing and sharing your writings for most of your life.
Yes, and I come from a family of writers. My brother Paul, who's my half-brother, he was an editor for the in-house magazine for Sears called Parents Magazine,
who
still writes today. He wrote A Genealogy of the McNair Clan. Then my sister, Patty McNair, is a creative writing teacher at Columbia College and helps people with their writing. She's published a novel. It was independently published. Mine is self-published, but ours was independently published. And it's called A Temple of Air.
Awesome. Awesome. Oh, I love it. I love it. And, you know, that is such a great creative outlet. What would you have to say? Do you have any words for any listeners out there that really feel they would like to write something, create something? Any words of advice for them?
I would say first get out a piece of paper and a pencil and start to write. Don't really think about what you're going to write. Just feel your passion and what you think is most interesting to you, and the words will flow on the page in an effortless way. But also, one thing that they could do is look for a local workshop for where it's the one that I did for the Chicago Writers Alliance was a workshop at Byzantium Library here in Chicago. And there are ongoing workshops where you share samples of your writings and others share their samples, and you trade ideas in a positive and affirmative manner in terms of encouraging the person to write.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So basically just get out there with the pen and paper and let it begin.
Yes.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Have you done any counseling or taught any classes to others about writing, or have you mentored anyone, would you say, with your techniques?
Yes, I've mentored a Pakistani Muslim who is in an art master's class, and now an arts PhD class, and I've been able to assist him with his writing by bringing him helpful suggestions, and it's actually helped me to grow in thought, looking at the ideas that he wants to express and helping him to express them.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That, how was it for you to meet people around the world? I know myself, I just absolutely love meeting others and seeing the other cultures, experiencing the food. It really opens our eyes, doesn't it, when we can go outside of just a U.S. view.
Yes, I find that early on, my mother mentioned this little story where I would go up to people on the streets of Chicago, introduce myself, and say, "Hello, I'm Alan McNair. What's your name?" So I, from the very beginning of my upbringing, I had this natural talent of engaging other people. And my case manager recently, through Thresholds, mentioned that she found that I was one of the most skillful at networking with people, getting to people meeting their needs and having them meet my needs and engage in conversation very easily with them.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, and that's just the greatest thing we can do, is just to be open to others and come from a heart of wanting to help and bring hope and assist. And you are all of that, Alan. I am really excited to have connected with you.
Thank you very much. I also was trained in a thing called Wellness Recovery Action Plan, which is a system of self-exploration that people with disabilities learn to do good coping strategies. And when they are well, they do things like journaling, writing, maybe even drawing. And then when they're ill, they find that when they go back to these coping mechanisms, they heal themselves naturally.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, Alan, this has been so great. I have enjoyed you so much. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Paula.
Oh, you are so welcome. And a big thank you to the listeners out there. Love, hugs, blessings to everyone. To you as well, Alan. And have a great day, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
everyone. This is Paula Vale, founder of Wellness Inspired and host of the Why Am I So Happy show on BBS Radio. My passion is sharing the beautiful healing modality of Reiki with the world. I help you reach a new level of self-awareness and create a more confident and empowered version of yourself. Learn how Reiki will change your life. Go to wellnessinspired.com. When you live a life with love and compassion, you allow your blessings to manifest. Check out my Reiki training and Reiki practitioner mentoring program, and look for my soon-to-be-released ebook, Why Am I So Happy? At wellnessinspired.com and the paulavnetwork.com. Big hugs to everyone. Paula V. Welcome to another episode of Why Am I So Happy? Today I am going to share with you a fantastic gentleman who has been a guest on my For the Love of Reiki show on voiceamerica.com. I am happy to share with you today Mitch Pogue. He is a seasoned manager with more than 20 years of hands-on real-world experience guiding and influencing workers in the workplace in the United States. His teams have become some of the most productive and effective in the history of their organizations. He does so much for so many, and his life mission is to reveal the foundation leadership paradigm shift that will transform today's workplace in America and around the world. Well, Mitch, I want to give you a big welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Paula. It's great to be back with you. Just a privilege to be on your show.
Oh, thank you so much. I love having you. Well, let's begin. Please share with us what your definition of attitude is.
Well, you know, there's times that you'll hear people say, boy, does he or she have a toed, in short-term vernacular, mm-hmm. or they'll say, my goodness, that group has a negative attitude. And then on the positive side, they'll be, boy, what a positive attitude. How does that person always remain so positive? So when they're describing attitude, and that's one thing I've always appreciated about you, Paula, is your choice and your personal attitude to choose the positive and to think good of people and all the situations you're in. Your energy, your life is such a breath of fresh air, and that's one of the gifts of being able to join you again on your show. I so appreciate it. But as we think about the word attitude, and so we can kind of describe it or look at it and say, well, I see that. I see what you mean. But what I mean is that within ourselves, when I describe the word attitude, is the current state that we'll take, a relative position that we take on virtually anything or any subject. So if we say a group is having a positive attitude, a person has a positive attitude, we realize that in life they are choosing to be positive. It's not just a common response or a habit. It's not just something that they are that way. It's actually, when people say they have an attitude, it's a good one. They're describing something that's real, that someone is using right now, that someone is applying to their life so that they can be positive in this particular case by choosing to be a certain way or to say things in a certain way. In any given circumstance, there can be dozens, and based on all the people that are alive, thousands and millions of individual responses to a situation. So when I talk about attitude, I'm talking about that moment, that state of mind, that position mentally, emotionally, that we take within ourselves relative to virtually anything that's going on. Now, I like to relate it to aviation so people can say, okay, I relate to it. Basically, let's think about an airplane flight. And when a plane takes off and when it lands, it isn't just one single event. It's actually a lot. There's even thousands of tiny adjustments along the way within a flight, from takeoff to gaining an ultimate altitude and then descending and landing at the appropriate destination. It's not just something that happens out of the clear blue. There's tremendous thought that goes into it, and thank goodness with today's computers, that thought can happen very quickly. Now, the attitude. Do you know that actually in aviation there's terminology that a plane has an attitude?
Oh.
I mean, I think we'd always want it to be a positive one, wouldn't
we,
Paul?
Yes.
Oh. Let's make sure we have a positive attitude in that plane today. It means the relative position of the airplane based upon the horizon of the ground and where it's at, the altitude, the wind, all the factors that a plane is experiencing or that are moving on a plane while it is in flight. In every instance, it is being measured, it's being calculated, and then an attitude is being taken. An attitude is being designed by the pilot or by the autopilot with all the right things that are configured in there to make sure that plane has the right attitude. It's in the right position in the sky at all times till it finally lands its destination. That is a successful, effective attitude application. So if for you and me, we take off at home in the morning. We may land at work. We may take off from work and land at home. But in between, in our driving and even at work itself, we may have many interactions. In fact, we will, in which we will apply our own personal attitude to what's going on. Yes. I have some very strong feelings about attitude and groups and teams at work and where that comes from. But I think you now get a feel for the definition of the word attitude. How's that application apply for you here, Paula?
Oh, I love it. I love it, Mitch. I do. That's a great analogy. I would like to ask, how does paradigm affect attitude?
Well, I think this is one of the most important things, and I'm going to throw in another factor at the same time. There's two things I want to say and everyone to listen to clearly and distinctly. Paradigm informs attitude. Emotion fuels attitude. If that is paradigm informs attitude and emotion fuels attitude. And we'll talk more about the emotion part a little bit later. But right now, the way that you're going to learn to work with your own personal attitude and put it in the right position to have your safe and effective flight in life today, in the things that you're going to deal with today, you're going to deal with some turbulence. Well, when planes deal with it, they move up or they move down. You can learn to adjust your attitude to work with the turbulence and maintain a positive position at all times. That's paradigm. And I remember hearing that terminology more than 30 years ago when I first heard a speaker at a very large convention say, paradigm. And I sat up in my seat and I said, what? And that person ended up describing what paradigm meant. It's basically your worldview. All of your personal experience, your thinking, your value system, your choices, the examples that you've seen, the influence of others upon you, all of that goes into influencing you in your world, your personal view of life. Okay, that's paradigm. And when you come to any particular circumstance or situation, let's say the pilot is going along and they're at 32,000 feet and they're experiencing turbulence, or they get word that there's a storm coming and they need to move 500 miles to the north or to the south in order to avoid this storm, well, there has to be a paradigm that has seen and has a view of the situation to know what attitude to take to move the plane. So think about that for us personally. When we come across a situation, let's say someone is being a little bit challenging, a little bit impatient, and they're being a bit pushy, how do you deal with that? Well, if you take an attitude that you push back immediately without any other thought, I'm saying that stop, use your paradigm, view the situation, gather some information that says, you know, push makes push. So I think I'll avoid pushing here, but remain calm. And so now I've made a choice about my attitude that's definitely going to make a difference in my day.
Yes.
Just like a pilot say, oh, I'm going to make a choice to, oh, there's some turbulence. We're going to drop down about 4,000 feet and see if the air's a little calmer down there. Sure enough, it is. And they level out and said, okay, everybody, flight is fine. So you and I, Polly, that's the power of a human being. I am not simply a response, someone that pushes the button and I jump. I actually have the ability to think, to be aware of my world, and to make an informed choice that changes, determines my attitude. And then I can follow through with that attitude to determine how I'm going to respond today and in the end result of what I'm going to experience today. So I stay in charge. Paula, I think it's something that you do extremely well, that you've decided you have a worldview, that you have something bigger that you hold on to in your value system, that no matter what happens, you have enthusiasm, you have energy, you have appreciation, you express love, kindness, and all of those things. So I think that you're a very good example to the listeners. In fact, obviously that's why you're the host of the show. You have become very good at working with this thing called attitude, and that's how paradigm informs. Like that in form, it actually forms attitude.
Yes. Oh, I love that. And thank you, Mitch. And I actually have on the door at my office a sign that says, if I choose to be happy, no one can stop me. Because, you know, I really believe we set that tone.
That's fantastic.
I love it. Well, everyone, we have to pop out for a break, but Mitch and I will be right back. Thank you. Thank you, Mitch.
You're welcome.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. If you're just joining me, I am with Mitch Pogue. He is sharing some fantastic information and viewpoints and great perspective on attitude. And earlier in the first segment, Mitch, you talked about how emotions, you know, fuel our attitude. What is the role of emotions in connection with our attitude? I'd love to hear more about that, please.
Now, that's a good question, Paula, because as we are living through each day of our lives, and as I said, paradigm informs attitude, emotion fuels attitude. You can see when we get an emotion that is strong, that it can immediately affect our speech, it can affect our body language, it can affect many, many, many things. And one thing about emotions, some people say, well, they just are what they are, so whenever they come up, you let them be. But we've learned, and I think we would all agree, if you have a particular emotion to do something, And it's not a good thing. It's a negative thing. Or if you feel like you're going to have an outburst of some kind that may compromise a relationship, we don't do that. We typically hold back. We are reserved. We're careful. Our paradigm is informing our attitude, so we don't speak, say, or do something that would be offensive or be negative. And yet the emotion is over there pushing. That emotion is very difficult to handle. And some people just think, yeah, whatever emotion is, you do it. Well, I had an experience many years ago that I came across two words that surprised me. I was struggling at work and was trying to get things done. I was so overwhelmed that I felt like I could not get it done. I wanted to see my manager and said, you know, what do you do when you're deep underwater? It's, of course, such a terminology to use, a way to describe things. And you can't, you're not coming up, and then you get pushed a little bit deeper. And how do you not panic to get up when you have so much to do? And he kind of smiled, looked at me, and said, well, let me know when you figure it out. I thought, oh, wow. So my manager was having the same experience.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, and I think providentially, the very next day I received a postcard at home. And it was for a seminar, for a class that had to do with dealing with stress and anxiety and emotions in the workplace. And so I took that card back in the next day, and my manager, I said to him, hey, look at this. This actually came in the mail yesterday, and he was shocked. He said, are you kidding me? And I said, no, you know what we talked about? Yes. And I said, well, things happen for a reason. And I really think that this is something I need to go see and take this class. Would the company pay for it? He said, sure, go right ahead. And so I went and signed up for this class and went in, and right at the very beginning, as the instructor was giving an introduction and laying out the course and how things were going to flow, they said two words, emotional intelligence.
Love
and it's
it.
Like everything stopped for me. It's like a thunderclap went up. Emotional intelligence. I've never heard the two words together. Emotional intelligence.
Yes.
I thought, well, emotions, are emotions intelligent? Well, after I took the class and became aware of the concept, and you've heard it more and more. In fact, there's a couple books out on it now, and more information has been shared about emotional intelligence. I'd certainly recommend to the readers to look up the subject and read about it. There's some really good stuff out there. But I found out that emotions were not intelligent. Emotions simply are. In fact, they're power. And when to help them inform or fuel attitude, emotion can come up. And when you're in a situation, you could even be thinking in advance, wow, when I go into this particular situation, I'm going to need a very positive emotion. So you can bring it up. You don't even have to wait for it. You can intelligently talk to yourself like you're sign on the door. I'm going to choose to be happy. I choose today to be happy. And with that thought, you can also have a feeling or an emotion that comes in and fuels your attitude. And when your attitude has been set in the best way, you have the right position in your life about the things that are going on, and then you bring in a very positive emotion, you can get so much done. Now you're working intelligently and effectively in your life, and you're able to maintain, just such a good relationship with those that are around you and accomplish good things in your life. I have an example, you know, so the way that we're working here is, how do you develop a positive, a flexible attitude that will serve us well? It also has energy behind it. Well, it's using all those things that we've talked about, your paradigm. Continue to learn. Continue to gain new perspectives. Read from those. Listen to Paula about what it's like to be positive at virtually any moment. There's a couple of experiences that come to mind for me that have happened at work over time. I was working with an organization many years ago in which they were selling their store, and they had decided, taking an attitude that the store was failing, that it just wasn't right for its area. I had been transferred in as the store manager to help take care of the store while it was being sold. Well, I decided, I changed the paradigm, and I decided this was going to be a successful store. I had an energy and an enthusiasm with everybody that came in, the employees, the customers, the vendors. All of them began to support, and the business began to grow, and I was out making connection out in the community. I had decided with a different paradigm, a new view of this store that was going to be successful, and with a positive energy, brought it in, and together they worked very well. Not only did they not sell the store, they actually ended up expanding it to the employees that I had found when I worked there. One transferred in not long after I did. was considered somewhat of a challenge. It would be a person who was difficult to work with. In my direction, I had a different paradigm and a different energy. If you, you know, think about it, Paul, if someone's difficult to work with, then you take on a mental attitude because of your paradigm of them, your view of them is, oh, they're negative, they're difficult, so now I need to be stern, or I need to be stoic, or I need to challenge them and be forceful around them, or we're going to have a problem.
Yes.
Or I could change my paradigm and say, well, I think this person is just wonderful. And could I treat them wonderful and bring in a positive, wonderful emotion at the same time? Well, that's what happened with this individual. Amazingly, this person took off, did a wonderful job with our store at the time, was then promoted to manager, and that person became manager of the year out of all the stores.
Oh, my goodness. I love it.
Isn't that incredible?
Yes. It shows what can be done. Your attitude
is your paradigm. You can adjust your attitude. You can bring in a positive emotion, and working together, you can see very positive results.
Yes. Yes. This attitude, it can really influence our sense of happiness and well-being in general, wouldn't you say?
Oh, very much so. I remember when the customers would come into that particular location, and at first when I arrived, the colors in the store were not very bright. The lighting was low. It was not well kept. It was kind of dirty. And I noticed that because of the way it looked and it felt, it produced an emotion in other people that their sense is that it wasn't a very good place.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a very happy place. Well, we ended up painting. We added new lighting. We had brought in more products. I brought in things that the young people would enjoy. Previously, the young people were avoided because they were considered a challenge to the business, that they weren't a very good customer. And I embraced them as the best customers. And then they began to come and bring all of their friends, and they had a great time. Their sense of well-being changed in the store because of the way that they were treated, because of our paradigm and the emotion that changed our attitude towards them. The overall happiness, the crew were much happier. The customers, as they came in, they were so much happier. And when they came in, they purchased what they needed to. And I was able to serve them and take care of their needs. And it's very, very much that way. And I think, Paula, you know in your own personal experience that
your
radio show, when mm-hmm. people get on, I'm sure as people come to join the show, what are they thinking? Oh, I can't wait to hear what Paula has to say today. I just love the way I feel their own being inside.
Yes.
It's a sense of well-being, and there's an enthusiasm, and there's a happiness because, well, that's just the way Paula is. It's the way Paula talks. It's the way her show is, and the subjects she talks about are always having to do with how do you become a happier person, or how do I have well-being in my life?
Yes. Oh, thank you,
attitude.
Oh.
Attitude. It has such a huge effect in every way.
It does.
Paradigm and emotion, I think you can see how it works on attitude.
Yes.
You can go forward with it. You have the formula.
We have about 2 minutes left, Mitch. What last words would you like to share with the listeners?
Oh, you know, it's such a nice opportunity for you to share that. There's something that I've said for years that I think is extremely important. And this could be to those that are acting as parents, or there's those who are working as leaders within their organizations. It's a term that I heard many long time ago, and it stuck with me, just like emotional intelligence. And this one is attitude reflects leadership.
Oh, beautiful.
Attitude reflects leadership. And whenever I become part of an organization or I witness a group of people when I'm out in public or maybe in a retail space. The attitude that the collective group has, to me, is a reflection of leadership.
Yes.
And so it's an important thing for leaders to look at as a gift and say, how is the overall attitude of the team? And knowing that the leader can make such a huge difference.
Yes.
They can then choose to be positive, to inform their attitude with a positive paradigm and have positive energy and emotions flowing from them, so that the team takes on the flavor of that particular person. And one person can make a huge difference.
Oh, I love that, Mitch. I love that. Oh, thank you. That is a powerful message. This has been so fantastic. I could go on for another half hour, but I just thank you for joining us today, Mitch.
Oh, thank you very much, Paula. It's such a pleasure to be with you again and to feel the goodness of your show.
Thank you. And thank you to my listeners out there in the U.S. and around the world. I'm so grateful. Love, hugs, and blessings to everyone. Love, hugs, and blessings, Mitch.
Thank you, Paula, and to you.
Thank you.
Bless you.
Thank you. Goodbye, everyone.